Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with the legendary playwright Edward Albee. The Philadelphia Theatre Company is presenting his At Home at the Zoo. Jason Pfeiffer visits the Pearlesque Buckhouse in Bucks County. The National Historic Landmark Home has opened an exhibition that includes the long-lost manuscript of The Good Earth, Buck's most famous novel. And Susan Lewis visits the Sketch Club and the Plastic Club on Philadelphia's Camac Street, the Avenue of the Artists. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
American playwright Edward Albee was adopted shortly after his birth in 1928 and grew up in an affluent community outside New York City. He rebelled early and from age 11 was shipped off to a succession of boarding schools, including Lawrenceville and Valley Forge Military Academy, before finally finishing his secondary education at Choate, the only academic institution from which he ever graduated. From his early teens, Albee wanted to write, but worked without success on novels and poetry before turning his hand to theatre. In 1958, at age 30, he wrote his first major play, The Zoo Story, which premiered the following year in Europe, before making its debut in America several months later. The Zoo Story was followed by a number of other theatrical works, leading to 1962's successful, controversial, and award-winning Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? A Delicate Balance, produced in 1966, earned Albee his first Pulitzer Prize. He won a second Pulitzer for 1975, Seascape, and a third for Three Tall Women in 1991. Always controversial, Edward Albee's literary work critiques the human condition and often features biting dialogue from memorable characters. About 5 years ago, Edward Albee went back to his first play and added an opening act. The Zoo Story, about two strangers, Peter and Jerry, meeting at a park bench, became At Home at the Zoo, with a new first act showing Peter at home with his wife Anne before he encounters Jerry in the park. Edward Albee was in Philadelphia late last week to observe final rehearsals of the Philadelphia Theatre Company's production of At Home at the Zoo, and when I met with him at his hotel room, I first asked him if he had returned to the Zoo Story because he felt the characters had more to say.
I still thought that I hadn't done a complete job with the character Peter, that it was Jerry's play completely, and Peter was 2.5 dimensions, not quite 3. But then I got busy for several years. But then I thought about it again. I said, it'd be very easy. I'm not going to touch the Zoo Story. I wrote it a long time ago. I don't believe in second-guessing myself, and also I'm not the same person, right? So, but why don't I do a first act? Why don't I let us find out more about Peter? Why don't I write a play about Peter at home before he goes to the zoo? That which involved a woman I had never met, his wife Anne, because he mentions in the Zoo Story that he has a wife. But you know something? I knew exactly who she was.
How easy was it to reattach to these characters 40-odd years afterwards?
Very, very simple. I remember all of my plays, and I remember everything that goes on in them, and I probably unconsciously remember what I was after and why I wrote them. So it took about a week and a half.
After writing the first one in 3 weeks. Mm. That's quite a productive little succession of plays. You were.
That was all one play, I think.
Clearly, and you're only allowing it to be performed as one play.
Exactly.
Clearly, you were a different person writing the opening scene to the man you were when you were writing the original play.
Yeah, I think probably I'd gained a little bit more command of my facilities as a writer. Maybe I didn't waste as many words. And maybe I learned a few things about clarity and objectivity. Maybe. I don't know. But I certainly think it's the Peter that I wrote 40 years after the original Peter is the same guy.
And then was your relationship with these two characters different? They'd stayed the same. You were 40 years older.
Well, they weren't.
And that was that simple?
Yeah. When I was young, almost all the characters I wrote were a lot older than me. I'd never been older than me. But I was still capable of writing people older than me. Now, most of the characters I write are a lot younger than I am. But I'm still capable of writing people younger than I am.
But surely you have better perspective on a younger person having lived through their age.
Oh, I don't know. In theory, one does, yes, but not necessarily. We make so many compromises and alterations in our perceptions as we go on. I think probably I can see things a little clearer.
I want to talk to you about how you construct characters, because I've always thought of the way you work as being very much in the initial stages like a jazz musician, that you will take the theme of a character and you'll almost riff on him. You'll improvise for a little while.
I improvise a lot.
Before it actually gets to the page.
I don't write anything down for a long time. If I get a sense that there are a couple of people there, I have to find out more who they are. And so I'll take three of them, say, and put them in a situation that I know can't be in the play. And I'll improvise dialogue for them to see how well I know them. And when I know them well enough so that I can trust them, then I can put them in my play.
And do they then write themselves in situ?
Well, of course they don't, because they don't exist and I have to do it. But, I transcribe them. I don't write them down until they can speak for themselves, at least in theory. Then I write them down.
And this idea of you writing in a very musician, like a very composerly way, is that something you agree with?
Yes. That's something I learned from Sam Beckett more than anybody else. Clarity and precision. And a composer and a playwright, well, the composer puts notes and the playwright puts words down on the paper with many of the same markings. Playwright uses punctuation. A composer uses the duration of notes. And we both use sound and silence, right? That's what a play is made up of, speech and non-speech. And music's made up of sound and lack of sound, right? Rest of sound. So we do the same thing.
You say we, but it's you, it's Shaw, it's Pinter are the people who actually give those kind of very specific stage directions on the page.
Yeah, I put it down very carefully. I put down what I hear. And I hear duration as well as meaning. And so I put those things down precisely. A playwright's got to know the durational difference between a comma and a semicolon and a period.
And then are you ever accused of directing on the page?
Of course.
And how do you respond to that?
Well, it's my play. And I put down exactly what I see and what I hear. And that's what I expect the actors and the director to do, exactly what I saw and what I heard.
And you're here in Philadelphia, and obviously you're in the room with the actors, but you're not in the room every time one of your plays is produced.
No, I can't be, but I try to write with sufficient precision that I make it difficult for people to screw up. You see, there is the creative act and the interpretive act. The play is the creative act. The string quartet is the creative act. The string quartet that plays the string quartet doesn't go around changing the notes or changing the order of the notes. They play what's down there. And in a play, if the play is any good, that's what should happen, too. It gives the interpreters lots of leeway because there are many ways to get at the ideal goal. And so I don't tell an actor how to become the character. I expect them, that's their training. But I want them to become the character, not something vaguely related to the character. And I think that's reasonable.
And how do the actors feel, generally?
Good actors respect that and seem to enjoy it. Selfish, egotistical, and bad actors... You shouldn't work with them anyway, so it doesn't matter.
You said that, if I'm not mistaken, Pirandello, Chekhov, and Beckett.
Three most important 20th century playwrights for me.
Were they also the three that inspired you most, or do you know?
I don't know about what inspiration is. I have no idea. I don't know what the term means. I don't know what creativity means. I don't know what all these terms mean. They're so vague. Inspires me? I don't know. I'm a playwright, therefore I write plays. I'm a playwright, therefore I get ideas for plays. I translate from my experiences that I have. I'm not content to have the experiences, obviously. I need to turn them into something else. So I turn them into a play since I'm a playwright.
But do you ever acknowledge that, I don't know, people like Thurber is somebody who...
Did you say Thurber? Mm. James Thurber, one of my favorite writers.
Right, but that's what I mean. I'm saying I can see Thurber in you. And can
I
you?
Hope so.
Can you?
I hope I learned an awful lot from Thurber's humor. Oh, God, yes. Wonderful writer. Nobody reads him anymore. Do you read him?
I have read him, yeah.
Read him again. He's wonderful.
I want to talk about your relationship with the New York critics. They've both, in their sometimes disdain of you, actually helped you. The reviews for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf included one that said this was a play only for
dirty-minded women. That added a year to the run. I loved it.
Why have you not got on with them?
What is interesting to me is that when a critic doesn't like what I've done, the reaction is infinitely more personal than you would expect from a critic. And it has something to do that I shouldn't be allowed to write. There's something that I do that offends this guy so much that I shouldn't be allowed to write. It's not, it's a bad play, but there seems to be something else going on there. I've never suffered critics gladly, you know. Intelligent ones, I think, are wonderful, and ones that can barely, you know, write their way across a page, I'm not very happy with, and I've always made that public information, because I don't think anybody should read bad critics.
But you see, I think that might have been the mistake, that you criticized the critics.
Can't, you're not allowed to, I learned that too late, you're not allowed to do that. They're very thin-skinned people.
And do you think then there was a sort of a 9 or 10 year period, sort of fallow period in terms of what was being produced by you in New York? Was that as a result of this relationship?
In New York, I was getting produced everywhere else, all over Europe and around the rest of the United States, but not in New York City.
And was that because of the critics, you think?
Yeah, that was because of the critics, and a lot of producers didn't want to touch me because my plays, they knew, were going to get bad reviews. There's a thing called commerce in all of the arts, and commerce and excellence don't have much to do with each other necessarily. I mean, for example, the majority of commercial plays that are put on Broadway are a total waste of time. Nobody should see them. But they're put on not because they're any good, but because people know they'll make money. And that's the commerce of theater. And that gets in the way of the art of theater.
And something you've never been prepared to play along with. You have to write what you have to write.
You know, sometimes I wonder if I knew how to sell out, if I would have. I don't think so, though.
But you have been purposely contrary over the years.
No, I've not been contrary. I've held to a certain number of theories. That a play is any good, it should be done as written. And that the theater should be filled more with plays that ask questions rather than ones that give facile answers. And the theater should make us think about something. It shouldn't be an empty escapist experience. It should be engagement. Yeah, these are unpopular notions that I have. But I have those notions maybe because that's the only way I can write. Maybe I don't know how to write junk.
Do you think that it's all a part of this? Would you regard yourself, even from your early life, you were rebellious? Mm-hmm. Is that something that's there in your work, do you think? And is that part of what you are?
I don't know whether I take the term rebellious more as questioning. I think there are an awful lot of things that I run into, values and people and stuff like that, whose attitudes and actions should be questioned, because I don't think they're doing anybody any good.
But does that include, then, high school teachers? Because even from age 11, 12, you were questioning them quite strongly.
Then, when I was going, that's why I got thrown out of two prep schools and even got thrown out of military school, which wasn't easy. Even from the very beginning, I sort of knew young that I was going to be involved in the arts in some way. I didn't know what the arts were, but I knew that. And I started drawing when I was 6 or 7 or so, and started writing poetry when I was 8 or 9, and I always knew I was going to be involved in that area somewhere. And therefore, I concentrated in my education on the things that I thought would be valuable for that, which did not include math, sciences, and chapel, and a whole bunch of other things. I didn't have time for them.
You tried, as you say, many, many areas of the arts. You were writing long novels when you were in your early teens.
I wrote poetry first, then 2 really dreadful novels. I wanted to be a composer when I discovered Bach when I was about 12, but I had no talent there. But I know a great deal about classical music because a playwright has to know a great deal about classical music because the structures and the methods are the same. And I've also been interested in the visual arts a great deal because a play is also a visual experience. So all these things are important for a playwright.
But you went through right to your late 20s without it somehow working out. And then you turn around and write this play. You write the Zeus story in 3 weeks.
I don't know that I could have written it 2 years before that. I think everybody starts at a certain age. Bernard Shaw didn't write his first play till he was 42. Mozart wrote his third symphony when he was 6. You know?
There have been clearly times when you have taken classical forms and used them as a structure, as a framework.
Yes.
Was that always conscious, things like using counterpoint?
Yeah, since I educated myself in classical music real young, and by the time I started writing plays, I knew the repertory. I knew the literature of classical music very well, and a great deal of listening, more chamber music than other stuff, but that's wise because a play is chamber music. You can't get terribly literal about that, but it's a sense of of what you're hearing and how it relates to what you would have heard had it been music.
Are you still writing now?
Still? You mean now that I'm older than 50? Or?
Well, older than 80, actually.
Older than 80? Good God, yeah. Oh, yeah, sure, I've got two plays in my head right now. I was making notes on one of them as I was coming down on the train this morning.
And you still have that wow sensation. You say that at 29 or 30, you were sure that the zoo story was good. You knew you had that wow moment.
I know that looking at stuff that I've written in the past, you know, 5, 6, or 7 years, Three Tall Women, The Goat, stuff like that, I know that whatever talent I have has not collapsed. I'm still writing as well as I ever did. Better? I don't know. As well, certainly. And I imagine I'll keep on doing it until I go gaga.
Right, 90 or gaga was the...
90 or gaga. Well, I'm getting, you know, 81 now. You got to change that. 100 or gaga.
Edward Albee. The Philadelphia Theatre Company's production of his At Home at the Zoo is at the Suzanne Roberts Theatre through April 19th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Philadelphia's Broad Street corridor, with its concentration of cultural venues, among them the Academy of Music, the Merriam and Wilmot Theatres, the Kimmel Center, and the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, is hailed as the Avenue of the Arts. But the city also has an Avenue of the Artists, known during its history as the Little Street of Clubs. Tree-lined cobblestone Camac Street runs from Walnut to Lombard and is home to two of the oldest clubs for fine artists in the country. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores the Sketch Club and the Plastic Club as they carry on their legacies.
Hi, how are you?
Good, Susan, how are you?
Good, thanks. To see you.
Bill Patterson, president of the Sketch Club, welcomes us inside an early 19th century house where artists have been gathering for more than 100 years. The club started on 11th Street in 1860 when six students from the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts wanted to get together to work on their sketching skills.
But then after a while they had some social events and they started to realize that they gained artistically from those social exchanges at these events. And so it became more of a social club with a lot of camaraderie that gave artists a chance to network and see what other artists are doing and trade stories.
Art, of course, was the central focus, and workshops met the needs of a growing membership. In the 1870s, when the Pennsylvania Academy was temporarily closed down, a young artist named Thomas Akins taught life classes at the Sketch Club.
When the Academy opened their new building, his followers here petitioned the Academy to have an evening life class and to hire Akins as an instructor. So Akins had his beginning as an instructor here at the Sketch Club.
Other members over the years included painters Thomas Anschutz, Daniel Garber, and N.C. Wyeth. In the early 1900s, the club, with over 400 members, bought three adjoining houses on Camac Street and converted them to one clubhouse, with a library and kitchen, space to work in the light-filled studio which spans the combined second and third floors and also functions as a gallery, and places to unwind, like the basement Rathskeller, with carved chairs pulled up to long tables in front of a big fireplace.
One neat thing you'll see on the beams in here, there are drawings and artists' names and a peg. Here's the name, looks like Pitts, where Pitts would have hung his beer mug.
It was a great gathering place for artists, if they were men. Women artists were not admitted as members.
So they formed their own club.
Artist Betty McDonald is a past president of the originally all-female Plastic Club, which formed in 1897 and in 1910 moved into its clubhouse, also on Camac Street. The Plastic Club joined two houses to create its own upper studio with skylights, a basement tea room, and gallery and meeting space on the first floor. And the name? McDonald says it had nothing to do with what we think of as plastic today.
They used the term plastic art, which meant the malleable, solid art. They didn't want to be known as tea party ladies who appreciated art. They were actually in there with their elbows doing it.
And doing it professionally, as sculptors, painters, illustrators, and muralists. The club boasts among its founding members the three so-called Red Rose Girls who met in Howard Pyle's illustration class. Illustrators Jesse Wilcox Smith and Elizabeth Shippen Green, who worked for Ladies' Home Journal and Harper's Magazine, as well as muralist Violet Oakley, who created murals for Pennsylvania's State Capitol Building, Senate, and Supreme Court. The two clubs were male and female counterparts of the same artistic community, one that Betty McDonald grew up in. Her mother, Dorothy Hutton, worked in oils, etchings, and lithographs, and was a member of the Plastic Club, where she'd sometimes bring her daughter.
I used to come and pose, which I hated, because you get itchy when you pose, and you have to sit and be quiet.
Her father, Hugh Hutton, was an illustrator for the Philadelphia Inquirer and a member of the Sketch Club. Betty grew up to become a member and then president of both clubs. Around 1990, both went co-ed.
We let men in, which was a big change. My husband pushed for that. He said it's illegal to exclude men or women.
Today, some people like McDonald belong to both. Each club, though, has its own history and identity. The Plastic Club is low-key, all-volunteer, and focuses on its mission of providing a place for artists to come together to work and share ideas. Its current president is Bob Jackson.
And on the second Tuesday of every month, we have a salon here, and we just sit around and talk about art. We bounce ideas off of each other's heads.
Past president Michael Gwynn likens it to a gym for artists.
You can work out here and get better. And if you are already pretty good, you can stay good. It's a gym. It's for keeping your eye muscles in good shape.
And while Plastic Club members appreciate the over 100-year-old history,
we have no ambition to be important, to have any status. We gave our archives to the Historical Society. You know, they can take care of it. We don't want to spend our time preserving things. We want to be active and be friendly to the artists and let them come in and use the place.
In contrast, the Sketch Club actively preserves and promotes its history, keeping its archives close at hand. The library, ringed with portraits by Thomas Anschutz of members from the 1890s, has books and research materials collected over the years, and a large oil by Hugh Breckenridge of his wife and daughter, shown at the Academy in 1909, hangs prominently at the end of the room. In the last decade, the Sketch Club has taken on an executive director, Barbara Murray, who is working with member volunteers to coordinate a 150th anniversary celebration in 2010. She says art shows help carry on the club's tradition.
The six bohemian artists that began the Sketch Club were very interested in bringing the public into this mysterious world of art.
Down the street, Plastic Club member Alan Claywins is also the exhibition director.
We have about 9 exhibitions a year here. There are artists from all over the country.
But ultimately, both clubs exist to serve local visual artists, like Bucks County painter and Sketch Club member Alan Fetterman.
It's more and more difficult each and every day to survive exclusively as a fine artist. Not commercial artist, not an illustrator, but a fine artist. It's a hard go. And you have like individuals here, so you can communicate and extend values and exchange ideas.
Today, Philadelphia is a city rich in the arts, with big museums and flashy performing halls and theaters. Yet in the shadow of these modern-day grand gestures that light up Broad Street and the Parkway are a few blocks that recall 19th-century Philadelphia, where artists, many neither rich nor famous, have always had a home.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. On view now at the Sketch Club is an exhibition of paintings by member Donald Meyer, and opening April 10th, the 146th annual exhibition of small oil paintings. Both shows run through May 12th. At the Plastic Club, Think Green, an exhibition about ecology, opens April 5th and runs through April 24th. This month, the Pearl S. Buckhouse, a National Historic Landmark in Poughkeepsie, Pennsylvania, opened a new exhibition that includes the hand-edited manuscript of the 1931 book The Good Earth. Pearl Buck, a longtime Bucks County resident, received a Pulitzer Prize for the novel. This is the first public display of the manuscript since the pages were rediscovered 2 years ago. But as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the book is only one part of Pearl Buck's legacy.
Pearl S. Buck is best known as the author of The Good Earth, a story that traces the fortunes of a farmer and his family in rural pre-communist China. Born in West Virginia to two Presbyterian missionaries, Buck grew up in China, where she lived until she was in her 40s. Written in 90 days, The Good Earth was inspired by her experiences there. In addition to garnering the 1932 Pulitzer Prize, the book helped Buck win the Nobel Prize in Literature 6 years later for her larger body of work. Curator of the Pearl S. Buck House, Donna Rhodes, says The Good Earth was groundbreaking when it was published in 1931.
This is really the first window into an Asian culture that anyone's really ever seen at this point. The area of China is something that people really just have fables and stories about at this point. And here's a person who's lived there for 40 years, and she writes a story. And not only does she write a story, but it's a story that people can relate to and understand.
I first read The Good Earth when I was in high school, 50-some years ago.
Cindy Loudon is a retired high school teacher who volunteers as a docent at the Pearl S. Buck House. As both an educator and avid reader, Loudon says The Good Earth has great value.
For me, it was exposing students on the high school and college level to Asian literature. And I can remember being captured by that, because what did I, someone from the Midwest, know of China or Asia at all? Nothing, absolutely nothing. And this was before television and history channels, etc. So you had Pearl Buck's words, and it just was able to take you, to many places.
Pearl Buck's own exposure to other cultures, particularly that of China, helped shape a life dedicated to humanitarian work. She advocated for religious tolerance, women's rights, the mentally handicapped, and children. She had 7 adopted children of her own, and in 1949, she created the Welcome House Adoption Program, originally designed to find adoptive families for biracial children who were considered unadoptable because of their ethnicity. This first international adoption agency continues to operate today on the grounds of Buck's 68-acre Pennsylvania estate, under the umbrella of Pearl S. Buck International, which also manages the Opportunity House, a child sponsorship program started by the writer, and the Pearl S. Buck House, which includes an intact collection of Buck's home furnishings, library, artwork, and literary awards, all open to the public. Janet Mintzer, president and CEO of Pearl S. Buck International, says Buck's contribution to society clearly extends beyond writing books.
Her good work is continuing to make a difference in the lives of people in this century as well as during our lifetime.
The original 400-page manuscript of Buck's most enduring literary work, The Good Earth, disappeared in the 1960s. When Pearl Buck realized the precious pages were missing, she filed a report with the FBI, but the documents never turned up, until recently. The daughter of Pearl Buck's longtime secretary found the manuscript in a suitcase in her mother's basement. Curator Donna Rhodes.
I received a phone call from an auction house, and they were interested in knowing if we, in fact, knew anything about it and if we were interested in purchasing it. So after some information that we were able to convey to the FBI, they were able to go in and get the manuscript, and no charges were filed for anyone. There was no criminal intent involved. And really part of the situation is that a lot of the people are deceased at this point, so nobody really knows what happened or where it went.
Although the manuscript had resurfaced, Janet Mintzer explains its ownership was uncertain for a time. 3 organizations in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Vermont all laid claim to the famous author's legacy.
We weren't quite sure if it would belong here because it was left in the house, if it was the birthplace who made a claim that they owned the manuscript, or if it was the family trust.
In the end, it was agreed that the family trust in Vermont, formed by Pearl Buck's children, would take possession of the manuscript. But through August of this year, Donna Rhodes says the hand-edited draft of The Good Earth will reside in Pennsylvania on loan from the trust.
This is the manuscript right here. You can see, which I think is really interesting, the title has been crossed off in blue pencil. It was Wang Lung. And her editor said that it just did not pay enough justice to the magnificence of the manuscript. And he suggested the title.
And the manuscript here is in an enclosed case, and it's sitting on the original desk beside the original typewriter she would have used?
Yes, the typewriter is a Royal that she bought secondhand in Shanghai. And it sits on the desk. It's the chair that she used as well. And it's the first time since 1930 that the chair, the desk, manuscript, and the typewriter are all together again.
Rhodes says Pearl Buck was a prolific writer. She's credited with about 1,000 works, including speeches, short stories, children's books, and essays. She wrote 5 novels under the pseudonym of John Sedges. But Buck wasn't content to simply write. Empowered by the success of her publications, she continually took up the causes of disadvantaged groups in society and worked to build greater intercultural understanding. Indeed, when Buck died in 1973, She was buried on the grounds of her longtime Pennsylvania home. But instead of marking her grave with her English name, so familiar to her readers, the daughter of missionaries from West Virginia had her gravestone inscribed with her Chinese name, Tsai Zhenju, a lasting reminder of Pearl Buck's international legacy.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. As part of its new exhibition, The Art and Sculpture of Green Hills Farm, the Pearl S. Buck House in Perkasie, Pennsylvania, will display the original Good Earth manuscript through August. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.